You're listening to Tech Talk Radio in your backyard and worldwide on the pod.
Every once in a while, a revolutionary product comes along that changes everything.
Hello, welcome please to Telstra Customer Service. How may I be helping you?
Conform or be consumed.
Today is a very important day in Australia's history.
I heard a rumour today.
I like your rumours.
I know, as a parent, I would often say to my children, you've just spoken to this person for 8 hours at school, how can you sit online and chat to them for another 5 hours?
What is your environmental policy?
To sell Telstra.
You heard of road rage?
Yes.
What about web rage?
And within a few minutes.
Minutes?
Yeah, minutes. It's not minutes. XG, mate.
On air, on the internet, and on the pod. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's edition of Tech Talk Radio. I'm Andrew McComb. Google is the preferred search engine for Australian internet users, and according to Hitwise in February 2007, it's the place to go for 86% of Australian users. In second place was Yahoo.com with 4.2%, and third was Live.com with 3.7% of the market share. So why have Australians taken a shine to Google? Maybe it's because of its simplistic user interface, something lost on other search engines, or the additional features it offers, making the user experience simple and intuitive. Now, if you have a website, either for business or pleasure, chances are you want it to be found in search engines. Last week, Dr. Ron and I attended an SEO and SEM seminar in Melbourne, held by Net Registry, one of Australia's largest web hosting and domain registration companies. Did you know that Google changes its search algorithm in a minor way every few months, with major changes every 6 months? This is why your website is not set and forget. So if you write or publish anything online, we'll give you an insight into how you can make your site or blog more user and search engine friendly, thanks to the help of Sam Shetty and Justin Freeman. Also this week, can you tell there's a federal election coming? The campaigning by Howard and Rudd is in full swing, even though we're still a good 6 months out. Last week, Kevin Rudd decided to dig into the Future Fund to finance the Labor Party's broadband strategy. Peter Costello came out on the defensive, along with several of the Liberal Party's front benchers.
$2 billion of this funding will be drawn from the existing communications fund. The remainder will be taken from the Future Fund's 17% share of Telstra.
A smash and grab raid. Smashed the glass, taken the key, opened the fund and announced a plan to spend the money. Mr. Speaker, this is absolutely irresponsible.
So what now? There's plenty of water to flow under the broadband bridge in the coming months, but one thing's for sure. We, the consumers, will lose. While the rest of the world reaps the benefits of high-speed broadband, Australians seem set to wallow in fraudband.
This week on Tech Talk Radio.
Apple ships Apple TV. Google plans software, not phone. The ALP's broadband vision beats the coalition's blueprint. DVD game ads get the all clear. LG's TV freeze fix on wheels. Yahoo trumps Google on mobiles. And ICANN may offer domain registrants more privacy. All that and more on Australia's premier tech talk show, Tech Talk Radio. But first, let's find out what's been making news in the tech world this week.
This is Tech Talk News.
This week on Tech Talk News, Melbourne CityLink disaster leaves three dead and more hospitalised, LG televisions in Australia lock up on Digital Channel 9, Telstra offers NextG customer refunds, Microsoft enters the telephone arena with its first IP office system, and YouTube holds the first video awards. Welcome to Tech Talk News. There was drama in Melbourne last week when a three-car pile-up in the busy CityLink Burnley Tunnel left three people dead and two women and a child transported to the Alfred Hospital. Police say the crash involved three trucks and four cars and occurred shortly after 10 a.m. on Friday. The details of the accident are still unclear, but emergency services believe one truck swerved to avoid a broken-down truck with a blown tyre. This caused other cars to collide in the next lane, exploding into flames on impact. At a press conference, CityLink spokeswoman Jean Kerr-Walsh said that emergency management technology in the tunnel system was effective.
We regret that we ever have to mobilise those plans,
But today we're seeing the proof that they do work.
CityLink's manager of tolling and traffic systems infrastructure, Tom Bucher, spoke with Tech Talk Radio in November last year about state-of-the-art technology designed to anticipate and manage motor vehicle collisions.
The images from cameras get processed by a computer. The computer's smart enough to sort of go, oh, look, there's a car here, it's slowing down, or guess what, it's stopped. And within about 10, 15 seconds, they send an alarm off and the operator goes, oh, there's an alarm here. I'll go have a look at that camera.
So the computer system can detect an accident, you know, even as it's about to happen with a car slowing down, and bring that to the operator's attention.
Yep. CityLink spokeswoman Jean Kerr-Walsh asked Melburnians to be patient while the wreckage was cleared and the tunnel was again made safe for commuters.
We ask for people's understanding and tolerance as we all together, however long it might take, get ourselves to the position where we can reopen the tunnels and people can again have confidence in the CityLink.
Television manufacturer LG has identified a glitch which is causing new LG televisions to simply lock up when tuned to a Channel 9 high-definition digital broadcast. In the past week, owners of LG televisions have reported the problem in both Sydney and Melbourne during the transmission of Nine's high-rating current affairs program, 60 Minutes. Several owners of LG televisions, responding to a story by The Age last week, have also reported the problem in other cities, including Brisbane, Perth, and regional centres in New South Wales and Victoria. A full recall of the affected models has not been ruled out. The spokesperson said that the glitch is software-related and appears to have coincided with Channel 9 enabling an encryption system to prevent recording of its free-to-air programs. Telstra has promised to refund excess data charges to users of its new NextG mobile telephone network after failing to warn them if they exceeded maximum data usage limits. IT Wire reports that Telstra assures new NextG mobile phone customers that they'll receive an SMS notification when they reach 80% and 100% of their monthly data allowance, but that Telstra doesn't send warnings during the first 3 months of a new contract. Despite the launch of NextG several months ago, users have been unable to tell how much data they'd used until quite recently. IT Wire also noted that Telstra has some of the country's highest excess mobile data charges, ranging from 25 cents to $5 per megabyte, which includes uploaded data. Microsoft has unveiled its first PABX telephone system for small and home office businesses. The IP-based voice switch, distributed under an OEM arrangement with D-Link, Quanta and Uniden, is intended to compete with leading IP PABX vendors like Cisco, Avaya and Nortel. The voice switch, codenamed Response Point, is currently available in beta and is expected to be released later this year, supporting voice over IP and traditional analog phone circuits. Microsoft CEO Bill Gates talks about the speech recognition software in Response Point used for navigating menus and directing calls.
It contains the best speech recognition software we've ever shipped. And one of the reasons that Response Point works so well for small businesses is that it was developed by a team that operated throughout the development process as if they were actually a small startup company. What they found is that what small businesses really need is the ability to simplify the steps it takes to accomplish everyday tasks.
Response Point phone systems will come complete with a base unit, voicemail software and desktop phones. However, no information on system capacity has yet been released by Microsoft. And CNN reports that Lonely Girl 15, OK Go and other YouTube sensations will soon get an opportunity to walk down the virtual red carpet. Google's famous video sharing website has announced that it will hold the first YouTube Video Awards to recognize the best user-created videos of 2006. The awards will be handed out in seven categories: most creative, most inspirational, best series, best comedy, musician of the year, best commentary, and most adorable video ever. A YouTube spokesman said that annual YouTube Video Awards would probably become permanent, depending on how the first awards are received. And that's your tech update for this week.
Previously on Tech Talk Radio.
The United Nations copyright agency that arbitrates more than half the world's cyber squatting cases saw a 25% increase in complaints last year. So this is going to grow worldwide.
Moving from ADSL 1 to ADSL 2 and changing carrier is a bit of a messy business.
Have you heard of a site called Decrapify?
As Andrew was saying, at the bottom of any device, like whether it's a webcam or a printer or a modem or a wireless router, there's a little sticker with an FCC number on it.
PlayStation 3 in a SETI style attack on disease.
Now, $1 billion is like 100 million or 1,000 billion or, yeah, whatever.
PCM CIA card.
People can't memorize computer industry acronyms.
No, they're the little...
His main response was, why would you want to do that? You know, 850 is faster, it's HSDPA, and it's faster than the HSDPA the 2100's got.
I try going to speedtest.com with my mobile phone.
Uh-huh.
It just timed out, though.
Yeah, good.
Entertaining, informative, and independent. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Subscribing to the Tech Talk Radio podcast is so easy. It's child's play.
Podcasting's so easy, even my little brother can do it.
Step one, download and install some podcatching software, like iTunes. Step two, find the address of the Tech Talk Radio podcast feed on the Tech Talk Radio website. Step three, copy and paste the feed address into your podcatching software, and you're done. Now every week, you'll be able to listen to Tech Talk Radio whenever, wherever, and however you like. You could be mowing the lawn, on a train, in a car, on a plane, at work,
visiting the relatives, washing the car.
The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
Gee, it doesn't take long for a week to go around, does it, Dr. Ron?
A week's gone past and we're back here again. It's good to be back. This is about my third or fourth in a row now. It's just
not bad.
Habit forming.
Not bad. Graham, good evening. Welcome.
Good evening.
What a week it's been. The mud is definitely being slung at the moment in the world of politics when it comes to broadband in Australia. So it
certainly is.
We're going to be talking a little bit about that later. And also search engine optimization. What a show tonight.
Indeed. The broadband slinging is shaping up to be a large issue for the upcoming election, isn't it?
Yeah. And the election's still... I think we did the calculations on this in the office today. There's an Asian Pacific Conference, APEC thing, in October. So it won't be before that. And then it can go into Christmas, but it's too late for the poly. So it's got to be around mid-November. There you go. Heard it first on Tech Talk Radio. Early to mid-November for the federal election.
Very good. Very good.
Where we get to vote on which broadband plan we want to...
Well, it's going to come down to that and water this time around, don't you think?
It's going to be the crux of it for me, I think. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Anyway, let's get into the technological side of things this week. Dr. Ron, you got some emails? We've had a few emails this week.
We've had a few emails. I've actually got a Frapper update.
Frapper? That's where you stick the pin in the map.
It is where you
stick the pin. We haven't spoken to Frapper for a while because you haven't been here.
That's the thing. We haven't spoken about it for a long time. And hello to all our new listeners on our new radio stations all around Australia as well, because they may not have heard about Frapper. If you go to www.frapper.com, F-R-A-P-P-R.
Yeah, it's not how you think it's spelled.
No, there's a vowel missing. / Tech Talk Community, all one word. There is a map there, and you can put a pin on the map and show us whereabouts you're listening to the radio station from, or the radio show from. Hello to TD, who's put a photo there, so that's good.
G'day, TD.
Ping Up Post, which is really Huggies, he's got a photo there, which is good. And
hey, say that again? Has Huggies got a new...
Huggies has got a photo. Oh, he calls himself Ping Up... might be Ping You Post. That's his Frapper name.
Okay.
He's a man of many names. And Ian Sinclair's got a photo there as well. Lots of other new people have joined and popped a pin in the map, which is
fantastic.
Great. But check it out if you haven't looked at Frapper.
If you're not sure how to find any of these things, they're all linked from the Tech Talk Radio website at www.techtalkradio.com.au.
It is, in the pull-down menu there.
Yeah.
Pretty easy to find. All right, that's good. I had a couple of emails in this week too, just in relation to people sharing some good ideas with the show. Bring them on. I won't read any of those out just yet, but last week we talked about doing 10 questions. We've got a few little responses from that. There's some people out there with some very strange senses of humour. Nonetheless.
no stranger than some of our internal ones, I'm sure.
Oh, no. Oh, yes. One thing that is going to happen this week, a little different from what we've been promoting, is Adam from Google in the US is going to be moved into next week's show, unfortunately. So you'll probably hear a few promos throughout the program. You go, that was supposed to be this week.
Yes, that's Adam Lesnick from Google. It's turning into a double banger SEO show, isn't it?
Yeah, it's just because Mr. Rudd and everyone decided to do this thing with broadband that
we thought we'd best talk about that as well. So this week we're going to have a chat to the boys locally, and then next week a bit of a chat to the man himself, Adam Lesnick, from Google, hopefully, all things going according to plan, from Google in the United States.
That's the thing. Hey, uncapped ADSL1.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Here I am. No longer am I on 1.2 meg down. I've now got real broadband. This is real fast, true broadband.
Hang on, we haven't started the broadband segment yet.
No, this is just me. Yeah, 3 meg I've got now. Which is good. Yeah.
Okay, on ADSL1.
On ADSL1, Graham.
Don't choose it all at once.
Yeah. Well, hang on a minute.
Uncapped.
Yeah.
Yes.
So you're getting the maximum speed that the line can do.
The maximum speed that my telephone line can handle, yes.
Now, I happen to know that you live a long way from your telephone exchange.
I'm about as far away from the exchange as you can be, because on the other side of the road where I used to live, it's another exchange.
So although you're being a little bit sarcastic about your 3 meg broadband,
yes,
it's actually not too bad considering how far from the exchange you are. Well, I think you're doing all right.
Figure this out. Like, Dr. Ron's on the same telephone exchange as what I am.
Yes.
I get 7.9 megabits per second down. Would you be? You'd be about another kilometre further down the track?
Maybe a K and a half.
Would you expect, Graham, to see a drop of over half the speed in a kilometre?
Well, a kilometre down the main road, but it'd be a lot more than a kilometre in actual cable length by the time it runs around all the streets and around all the corners. Point. And also, I haven't looked at the nitty-gritty of the chart. And
I just thought that fell off a bit too quick for my liking.
The other issue, which we're all personally acquainted with, is that all it takes is one very bad, twisted connection somewhere.
Well,
in
you do have man up the pole issues. I've seen them at your place.
I do have man up the pole issues. That's right.
I remember the day that you got your new phone line connected, and they said, "Is this a spare pair? We'll use that," and took your other line out.
Indeed, and I have had issues with the ADSL in the past at my house where there's been a lot of noise on the line. You can actually hear it when you pick up you plug a handset in and
crackle,
dial tone. Yep. Crackle.
It's a bit of a shock.
And yes, that has been an issue, and Telstra had to come out and move pairs around and do things like that.
So there you go. If you're sitting out there in the bush suffering with lack of broadband, the only way you can get it wirelessly, think about us people that get it on the cable.
But it is, as Graham said, yes.
Was it raining when you did your speed test, by the way? Because that can have an effect.
It might have been. I should do it again, but it is nearly three times faster than what I'm accustomed
to. Well,
that's good. So that's a little step forward.
Did you know that the rumours about is that broadband should start in this country at around 12 megabits per second. How inadequate does that make you feel?
Well, I'm paying nearly $70 a month for the privilege of 14 gigabytes at 3.3 meg. So if I could get it starting at those sorts of speeds, Andrew, for that price, I'd be
then
very impressed.
You'd get to your 14 gig a lot quicker.
I would. Yeah, I'd need
and
more.
And you'd still be unhappy.
Well, I've got about 21 megabits per second down at work.
Yeah,
and I can blow my 40 meg in just like that.
Yes, you would. That's on ADSL2, and you're very close to your telephone exchange.
Very
where you're
close.
At work,
less about 800 meters.
Of Lonsdale Exchange. Yeah.
Having said that. The thing I have noticed is when you do get the privilege of having lightning speed broadband, you'll find that it's like getting stuck behind the VW on the autobahn. If you do get into a place where bandwidth is slow,
on a website that hasn't got the fastest connection.
Yep. Now I've noticed that you pull things down out of the United States, 350 kilobits per second out of a possible 1.1, 1.2 megabits per second is what you get, even on ADSL.
But quite often you can do four or five of those at once.
That's exactly right.
Yep.
You can do four or five of those at once without detrimentally upsetting your VoIP and all the other things that would normally.
I was just going to say, make a phone call at the same time using a VoIP service.
That's exactly right. Yeah,
that's the test.
It is.
And if you can be downloading your latest updates for your operating system while the person beside you is quite happily surfing at full speed, that sort of stuff, yeah.
Now, we digress a bit here. We've got a show to do, and we're running over.
Let's go.
Very tight.
Let's go.
If I said the word, I'm going to digress a bit more, Personal Computer Memory Card Interface Association, what would that mean to anyone?
Absolutely nothing.
People can't memorize.
Personal Computer Memory Card International Association.
That's the acronym we couldn't remember last week.
That's the one.
PCMCIA.
And now you know why you couldn't remember that acronym. That's what PCMCIA
stands
for.
Now, I've got a little suspicion that it also has at some point in its life stood for something else, and that association was made to fit the acronym at one point.
Maybe we should get people to send in an acronym. There's been some funny ones around for some of the other industry jargon lately, but we won't go into that on air.
We should do it one day.
The United States... CD sales absolutely plummeted. 20%.
Oh, what a shock.
In the first 3 months of the year as downloads continued to hit record revenues. 89 million CDs were sold from the start of the year to March 18, compared with 112 million CDs sold during the same period in 2006. Is this it? The end of the compact disc as we know it from an audio point of view?
Are we talking about compact discs in the sense that we're buying blanks to put data
no,
on
them? We're talking about music CD audio, CDA from the record shop.
Right.
I bet blank CD sales have gone up by a much greater amount than the CD recordings have dropped.
Well, I would have thought so.
More than likely, but wouldn't you think they've gone over to DVD media now?
Oh, but maybe.
You still have to download your music and whack it in your car.
You've got to put it on a blank CD to play in your car, that's right.
Hmm. So there you go. Is it the end of the CD audio as we know it? I must admit, I haven't bought a CD for ages. I actually bought something on iTunes the other day. It's very frightening, really.
There you go.
I was in Richmond today, and I walked past a secondhand CD store. And I thought to myself, I said to myself, I haven't been into a secondhand CD store for donkey's years. Because I used to do that,
Not since that other radio project we were involved with years ago.
Yes, quite. And well, that's just exactly right, Graham. We used to go into those stores, used to make like a monthly pilgrimage to places like Dixon's and those sorts of stores. And we'd go through all of the old audio discs and you pay your money for your pre-loved CDs. And
absolutely.
It was a lot of fun, but I haven't done that for years and years and years.
Apple. They shipped Apple TV, this week, yes. $299 or $372 Australian. Is this going to take off? We spoke about this when we had Justin in. You reckon any of your friends going to buy it? Anyone here?
I think that it might take off, and what we've seen in the past is MP3 players, for example, very good example, and they come onto the market, everyone thinks that they're terrific and starts using them, and suddenly the iPod appears. A lot of people are saying, well, look, Apple TV, now there's already media extenders, and there's already products like Media Center and things like that, but now that Apple has launched an Apple-branded product, maybe this will, sales just go through the roof.
A lot of the others have got little problems. They do 99% of the things you want to do, but you know the one that has all the right features doesn't have the wireless connection, or the one that has the wireless connection won't play your MP4s. So maybe Apple are going to get down to. I haven't looked at the specs of the Apple TV, but
yes, I have a lot of issues.
Maybe they'll get something that'll make the market.
I have a lot of issues with Apple at the moment, but I'm going to save those for another show. There's some pretty dodgy stuff out there at the moment, and I've got a certain member of the colleague in the office who's really very annoyed. He would have thrown his Mac. He's gone through about three or four in about as many weeks, let me tell you. But anyway, that's for another show.
Yes.
Google plans software, not phone, as to what we spoke last week. Google is building software to run on services on mobiles rather than gearing up to build its own phone, as many industry sources have speculated, including us last week.
They said, stop gas bagging about us. We're not making a phone. Go away.
Exactly. They're making an operating system to run on your phone.
So just watch out. There'll be those little applets pop up on your 3 and your Telstra and all those sort of things, so you can burn more in bandwidth on your broadband.
Well, I'll tell you what, the average mobile phone, it's got a small PC in it in terms of power.
Well, the iPhone's got a Mac in there. They've just locked it down, so you can't do anything on it.
And that's right. But and this is a huge sort of untapped potential. So Google, who are good at this simple, basic, really actually works user interface, like you see on their website, there's just a slight off chance that they might get it right.
Mm. Slight. We'll see. DVD games. You know those things? You know how at the moment you go into a cinema and you see an advertisement on the screen that says subject to censorship, but yet they can still show you a commercial for a film, which hasn't been through the OFLC yet. That's the Office of Film and Literature Classification.
Mr. Dickey.
Really? Yeah. You know him?
Not personally.
No, okay. DVDs were never of that way inclined, but the government's going to change the laws, which means they can advertise DVDs without having censorship from the OFLC, because as our listeners are no doubt aware, everything that you see on television, everything that you sort of see on a video game or DVD must be classified, whether it be through the OFLC or other independent organisations. And video games are no different when they come into this country, and some are refused classification, which we've heard about. But this is going to be a bit of a loophole. Maybe we're going to see some of these things. And I think you were talking about it recently, Dr. Ron, too, a game that came onto the market here that was banned. And
well, they just decided to sell it off a US website so that it wasn't subject to Australian laws.
Mm. Well, apparently Philip Ruddock reckons that it'll change and streamline the classification progress and reduce the regulatory burden on industry. I think we're going to see a lot more strange, deranged video game ads come on screen, and then they're going to go, oh, that shouldn't be being advertised. Let's give that an M classification. Of course, for those of you who don't know, you can't advertise an M product in a G classification on television.
Right.
You're just not allowed to do that. So there you go. And then finally, before we go to the break, ICANN, the organisation that sort of lets us do things on the internet with domain names.
It assigns IP addresses and names and numbers.
That's yes. Right. One of the biggest problems, which I think everybody in this studio is no doubt aware of, is that when you register and get a domain name, your contact details are published for all the spammers in the world to send you spam.
Yes.
ICANN are thinking of changing this.
Oh, good.
About time, I'd say.
Good. How are they proposing to change it?
Not sure, but they've basically touted it at the moment. I've got an article here. It doesn't really say, but they've probably hit the wall because a lot of people are actually faking their registrations now so that they don't actually get spam. So the worm's turning for the wrong reason.
Graham, the email address that you provide as a contact when you register a domain name...
Yes.
Is that usually, in terms of what you do yourself, do you have one set up that is just designed to receive messages that... Do you ever look at it? Is it a legitimate email address, I guess is what I'm asking?
It is, but it's one that does get an awful lot of spam. So. Yeah.
Can I tell you what I do? I have one email address which I register all my domains to, and then when the spammers get hold of it, fortunately, the registrar that I use lets me change it all in one foul keystroke.
So you can just make a very minor change on your mail server and you can go
add an extra
registrar.
Letter to my email account and it just, there goes the spam.
How often do you have to do that, though?
I do it once a year.
Well, it's not too bad.
Not too bad. It's the .coms. It's not the Australian.com I use. It's more the .com.
Well, the Australian ones don't show the domain name public, the email address anymore.
That would explain it, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. And they point it back to the registrar or something like that. Anyway, you're listening to Tech Talk Radio. We are sitting here. We have the laptop here. Jeff Dudley has sent us an email. Great show as usual, guys. We haven't finished it yet, Jeff. You're a bit premature on that email, I'd have to say.
But thank you kindly.
Thanks already. You must be going to bed early or something like that tonight. Feedback at techtalkradio.com.au or on air at techtalkradio.com.au is our email address, and we love hearing from you. When we come back, here we go again, broadband Australian style.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Next week on Tech Talk Radio, we'll tell you all about search engine optimization. Google has 80% of the search engine market here in Australia. So if you've ever had to build a website or you're about to build one, next week's show is not to be missed. We'll hear exclusively from Sam Shetty and Justin Freeman from Australia's Net Registry, along with expert opinion from the Google search evangelist himself, Adam Lasnik, from Googleplex at Mountain View in California.
The way I think is a better approach is, how do we optimize our site for users? That typically translates into better crawling, indexing, and ranking on Google, and I would assume the other engines as well.
A not-to-be-missed program next week on Australia's premier tech talk show, Tech Talk Radio.
Tech Talk Radio wants your feedback. Call the Tech Talk Radio feedback line or visit our website and tell us your thoughts on the show. Tell us your likes and dislikes, your technical dilemmas and program suggestions. Call 1-300-664-882 and leave a voice message. That's 1-300-664-882 or visit our website, techtalkradio.com.au, and click on the feedback link. The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. You're listening to Dr. Ron Graham Callaghan and myself, Andrew McComb, here. And we're going to talk about our pet subject tonight, broadband in Australia. Well, not that it's our pet subject. It's just that it's so dominant in the press, the mainstream. We've got elections coming up shortly. All sorts of things are going to happen. And whilst we're in the break, actually, Adam Turner sent us an email. He's saying Apple TV's $4.49 in Australia. I guess he should know.
So, $4.99.
Yeah,
I'll have to have a look at that.
Says here in the article that I've got from the Australian IT that it was $3.72. But nonetheless, that's the conversion, I suspect, from the
US. Yeah, that's the US dollars. So that'll be the local version. That's good.
Yeah, local version's Apple one a bit locally, obviously. So thank you, Adam.
Yeah, thanks for the update, Adam.
So now let's talk about broadband in this country. You know what happened during the week? It was a bit of an announcement, if you didn't sort of see it, which sort of distracted from a few other things that are going on politically at the moment.
Now, what's Labor going to do? They're going to raid the slush fund.
Well, they are. There's this great thing called the Future Fund, which I'm not sure whether you're familiar with, but in a nutshell, it was set up to look after pollies when they retire. Their superannuation and all that was to come from the super from the Future Fund. Now, what makes up the Future Fund is the remaining 17%, I think, of Telstra shares. I think it's 17%.
Yep.
That they didn't sell on T3 because they didn't want to flood the market and push their own stock down. Well, yeah, good. What are we going to do with that? Let's put in a fund, guys.
Right.
So it's basically got the remaining so Telstra, 70% of Telstra in it.
Effectively, they're using the Telstra sale to fund broadband infrastructure in Australia.
Well, they're using a byproduct of the Telstra sale.
They're selling national telecommunications infrastructure to build new telecommunications infrastructure.
Pretty much. In a nutshell, what's happened is they want to nick $4.7 billion from this fund.
Yeah.
And their goal is within 5 years.
Now, that's not a huge proportion of the whole fund, is it?
No, exactly right. But the thing is, I didn't think 4.7 would be enough, to be all honest.
4.7 billion, yeah.
Just if you think about it, their goal is to get to 98% of Australians broadband with a minimum speed of 12 megabits per second, not the 3 that you're getting or the 7 that I'm getting at home, Dr. Ron. This is 12 megabits per second.
98% of the country.
Mm.
And they're going to achieve this by using...
In 5 years,
allegedly,
apparently.
The fibre to the node technology.
Well, yeah, in essence, they're following along the lines of what the G9 have sort of said in the course of time. Now, Mark is not here to sort of wave the Telstra flag here tonight, so but it'll be interesting.
I would assume that to get to that proportion of the country, 98% of the population, you'd need to use a combination of fibre to the node and wireless, you know, next G type solutions, as well as possibly some satellite in some places.
Exactly. Along with this is what it says here in the press release, the national broadband network will be funded using existing government investment in communications to provide a public equity investment of up to $4.7 billion in the new broadband network.
Okay.
Read into that what you want. That's probably a very broad statement. But so anyway, what's happened is Kevin Rudd, election times, come out and he's popped out and he's sort of said this.
Kevin Rudd, federal opposition leader.
That's right. And I guess what we'd like to talk about tonight is the division that it's going to create between parties and also from a political / technological point of view. And politically, it's going to be quite interesting just because of the nature of the beast that we have an election coming up. But just an observation of mine. I don't know whether any of you guys have seen Helen Coonan, the opposition... member for communications. She's based in New South Wales, I think. She was very uneasy on her press conferences the other day. So I have a feeling that things aren't too good in that camp at the moment in the...
In the communications department
side of things. Mm. Even she was on Barry Cassidy's program on Sunday morning, The Insiders. And, very interesting. It was the rhetoric's becoming more political than it is technologically based, and I think that's not going to be in the interest of the community in Australia, because at the end of the day, it's you and I that's missing out on what the rest of the world is going forward in leaps and bounds. And while these parties bicker...
And try to save political face.
Telstra say, no, we're not going to do it that way because we've got the Telstra slant on it, we've got the G9 slant on it, we've got the political slant on it.
It's not helping our broadband deficit in real terms,
no,
is it?
No, exactly right. Now, here's an interesting statistic. Depending on which analyst you talk to, the lack of high-speed broadband network has cost Australia anywhere between $10 and $30 billion in recent years.
Through lack of investment, business opportunities and such things.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Now, just call me simplistic here, because the future of our country is going to be based on interacting on broadband, whether it be for fun and games, whether it be for serious business applications or what. We're going to have to do our thing on the broadband. Now, if it's cost $10 to $30 billion in recent years, what's it going to cost in future years? That's the question that I'm very interested in. And then you get these pollies that come out.
That's exactly the price of getting it wrong.
And then you hear these pollies talking about all sorts of things like, well, you know, you're going to steal from the future fund. Well, hang on, this is the future, regardless of what they say. But anyway, that's just my soapbox. I'll come down now. A lot of interesting bickering, as I said, that went on during the week. Some of it political and some of it more in the technological side of stuff. And I think... tonight, let's start off. We're going to hear from Matt Healy from the G9, and this is his reaction to the announcement by Kevin Rudd.
If there's a beauty parade where the winner is the contestant with the broadband plan that's most pro-competitive and pro-consumer, then I think the G9 will win the crown and sash and beat Telstra at every time. We're very encouraged that many of the aspects of the G9 plan appear to be incorporated. In particular, we're pleased that there's policy principles of pro-competition and pro-consumer. For too long, really, the industry's been held hostage to a proposition that it's Telstra's way or the highway, but we're clearly seeing a move away from that in this latest release of policy, and certainly it's a move that the G9 would encourage.
Telstra's way or the highway. And that's fairly, I would say, fairly, I don't know, realistic, don't you think? Telstra through the ACCC, through the Bull Terrier, Phil Burgess.
Your friend.
My friend. But wouldn't you think that that would be fairly, you know, consistent with the argument that's going on? You're all speechless, boys, I can tell.
The cogs are turning in my head. I'm just trying to really come to terms with all the ramifications of...
It is. It's a big thing,
isn't
it?
Who's taking what sides and who's steering who in which direction. And also, as you said before, the implication that it's going to start to get more and more political as we approach the end of the year.
What do you mean start? It's getting right now.
Oh, like, but it's going to get worse, isn't it? It's going to get a thousand times worse, you know, as the year goes on. And it's not going... We're just all going to fall by the wayside. All the constituents are going to get left behind with their slow-speed internet access.
And time has passed, and one might ask the government what on earth's been going on. Senator Coonan was asked this on the weekend, what the state of broadband is in Australia and what the government's doing.
There's broad agreement, I would have thought, that we need a fast broadband system throughout the country. And I really must say that I don't know where all these newly hatched, if you like... Broadband experts have been, because the government has actually been out there for the past 2 years investing in broadband in underserved areas in rural, regional and remote Australia, such that the investment's been about $2 billion for connecting people. I'm shortly to announce, following a long tender process, a new wholesale access open network in regional Australia. We've also put aside a fund to ensure that there's a guarantee that no matter where you live, you will be able to access broadband. And finally, we've put in place a communications fund to ensure that upgrades can be made for the future. The issue really is going to be what happens in commercial areas.
Well, what happens in commercial areas is interesting, but 98% of the population is going to get 12 megabits per second. I wonder what the other 2% are going to be, what they're going to get. And also, you look at what you were saying earlier on in the piece, the government's about to make an announcement. Well, I'm going, hang on a minute. Like, this is a very serious decision that the country is about to, or the politicians are going to make about our state of broadband. Now, wouldn't you think now is the time to get this job done right and get it done right the first time?
I think Helen Coonan was hoping to slide in the... We had the announcement a few weeks ago of the new Australian broadband guarantee.
Now, that in itself is contentious.
Well, it is, and it was amid much fanfare at the opening of the Australian Telecommunications User Group conference in Sydney. And I think that she was hoping just to slide that in and ride that through to election time and hope that was going to look good and that was going to satisfy everybody's thirst for some direction and some announcement on the part of the government. But I think she's been surprised, and she did sound rather on the back foot there in that that little grab, Andrew, with this announcement or this proposal by G9. It seems to have caught the federal government quite off guard.
I'd have to agree with you. She was sitting there jingly-jangling with her bracelety thing at the time. So she,
her worry beads.
Well, not really. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. We've got this opportunity where we're about to spend billions of taxpayers' dollars, potentially, as well as rolling out some private enterprise money in doing this network. Now, let's look at the history. We're not known for doing things clever. How many, you know, we've got the Optus cable up in the sky in most of the major city centres, and we've got a Telstra cable under the ground, and it does exactly the same thing. We've got two infrastructures. Now, where was the government back then? Sort of, you know, they just let them all go, didn't they? For what? For what?
A lot of wasted infrastructure there.
Exactly. So let's do this properly. Now, the other question which I've got is we're aiming for a broadband network of 12 megabits per second.
Right.
Go back three years ago. I'm pulling 3 years out because what was the fastest back there? 1.5 megabits per second?
Yes.
So 1.5 megabits to 12, which we can now, in effect, sort of aim for around 20 megabits per second. In 3 years' time, we're going to be looking at 100 megabits per second, and that's on Telstra stats, you know? Now, what future-proofing is this network going to allow so that we can have high speed in excess of... You know, what we have now, like, you know, 1.5 is slow compared to what we have now in a lot of respects. What are we going to be doing in 5 years' time when we've got these really ubiquitous super high speed networks? Are the politicians of today going to allow enough headroom?
That's a very good question.
And even for demand, because at the moment, what, we've got 25% of Australian households online, and that's a, I'm just reading from recollection, really. What happens when the population goes, yeah, we've got to have broadband because that's the only way we can do our banking. That's the only way we can buy our shopping or pay our rents or whatever, because people are going to go that way.
Yep.
It's just a matter of course.
And if in 10 years' time you find that the average household has got, instead of having one computer, they've got two computers or three computers and they're all networked and people are starting to do a lot more online, we have to have the capacity to be able to carry all that traffic, don't
we? Absolutely.
David Foreman is the executive director of Competitive Carriers Coalition. Never heard of that organisation before until the other day when I was doing some research. This is what he had to say, and it is. It's the best opportunity to get it right.
This process sets up a once-in-a-generation opportunity to get the structure of the industry right, and it's a once-in-a-generation opportunity for people to put forward an enduring business model to have what should be a very valuable investment. The transition to a new fibre-based network presents a tremendous opportunity to break with the problems of the past by getting the structure of the industry right. If we're going to build a new fibre-based access network, the worst thing that we can possibly do is have it structurally integrated into one company. The best thing we can do is have a look at the best structure that we can come up with and have it as a separate entity.
Remember when the government owned a company called Telstra? It was sort of a bit prior to...
They did like telecommunications infrastructure and that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
That's the sort of stuff that we need.
It was a government-based organisation that,
yeah,
that earned money and put that money that it earned back into...
Into actually providing
the technology.
Yeah, and looking after the network and maintaining it and providing an adequate level of service.
Network maintenance.
Network maintenance,
that's
yeah,
right.
Yeah, that's the thing they used to do to the network back in the old days.
Well, yeah, that's right. We've moved away from that model now, but hey, to me it's still a fairly good sort of model, I would have thought, to have some government-based institution rolling out this network and putting the money back into it as it rolled out and then sell bits of bandwidth to the carriers.
That's right.
Anyway, governments don't do that these days.
It's absolutely right, though, that it is a generation, once-in-a-generation chance to get it right. And if we get it wrong, we'll be dealing with that fallout for a long time to come. Like, the reason that digital television in Australia is crippled is because of that messed-up rollout of pay TV cable years ago.
But even still, digital TV was announced in this country in the year 2000. That was a long time ago. That was 7 years ago. They announced there and then that digital TV or analog TV would be closed down for digital-only TV in 2008. Well, hey, guys, that's next year. We've had that extended.
Mm.
Would it not be in the minds of the politicians to say to people like manufacturers, guys, no, we don't want analog receivers in televisions anymore that's being imported into this country. We want digital TVs.
But if they hadn't messed up in the first place, they could have allowed digital television to do what it does in every other market in the world and provide extra channels and provide extra services that they don't allow here. And the reason they can't do that is because they've got to prop up the pay TV networks that spent far too much rolling out duplicate infrastructure. And if we do the same thing in broadband, we'll be in the same messed up state in 10, 20, 30 years' time.
Senator Coonan was asked, how important is it?
Very important that we get this right. There is a lot at stake, and simply raiding the Future Fund, robbing from the bush and dismantling the competition regime and investing in some pie-in-the-sky proposal where the government's going to become a half-owner of something that's just sold is really a very flawed proposition. There will be an opportunity for a provider or a group of providers to be able to roll out a fast fibre network very soon, much earlier than Labor's could, within 3 years to the capital cities, and then to a much broader regional footprint. That's what I'm working on, and that's why I expect to be able to deliver, and without a $5.7 billion injection from public funds.
Well, I can't wait to see the detail on that.
So it's good that Helen Coonan's working on that at the moment. Well, G9's already got something ready to go.
Can I just say that the question was asked, and I'm sorry I clipped that a bit, the question was asked, how important is it? She answered that in about 5 seconds. The other 34 seconds of that was political.
Yep.
So we've moved away from the technological side of it straight into the political. We've gone to bag the opposition's idea, and we've gone into raiding the Future Fund. And that's really the essence of potentially this campaign coming up fairly shortly. So... speaks volumes, really, doesn't it? Paul Budd is an independent analysis. He's been doing the rounds of the waves at the moment too. It was interesting, some of his articles about Telstra's participation in the new G9, because from my understanding of it, the G9 put out a proposal which Telstra said, no, nah, it'll never work, poo-poo. The Mr Rudd's put out a proposal which is not too dissimilar from what the G9 put out. Telstra think that's all right. So we're getting mixed messages here. Well, from what I've been reading in the mainstream papers and things like that, we've been getting a few mixed messages. But nonetheless, Paul Budd came out, and this is his thoughts on Telstra.
These are all issues that Telstra really has big problems with. And in the end, we do need their cooperation. As long as Telstra does not really get a clear message, it will of course try to use its monopoly and will of course try to maximize profits rather than looking at the national interest. So it's up to the government to say very clearly, like they've done in Britain and in the Netherlands and in Sweden and in other countries where they said, listen Telstra, listen British Telecom, listen KPN, this is what you have to do. This is the law as from today, yeah? And unless the government very clearly indicates to Telstra what is the law, Telstra will try and find a monopoly rather than sharing.
Yeah. Fine point. Because you've got to remember now that because Telstra has been privatised, they've got shareholders in the back of their mind. You know? That's what they've got to do. They've got to...
They should have their shareholders in the front of their mind. Let's be honest about this. They've got to look after their investment, their shareholdings.
Exactly. And as a result, I think we need government intervention to come along, as Paul said, and said, make the rules, make the playing field.
That's exactly right. It's government's job.
And which I think, unfortunately, our current leaders are just not living up to that expectation. Would you agree, Dr. Ron?
I think so.
Man, many words tonight. Also, we go back, we'll have a bit of a listen to David Foreman again, and this is his thoughts. Now, David Foreman was the Executive Director of Competitive Carriers Coalition, and for this to work, it really does need Telstra's input because, hey, they've got a lot of market share.
The decision that Telstra makes about whether it participates or not is one that it's going to have to think long and hard about. If it says, no way, we're taking our bat and ball and playing our own game, then I think it's probably going to find under this proposal that if there was a Rudd government, that they would take a very hard line. They would pick someone else as a winner, and Telstra would be forced to participate by one means or another.
And that's really what it's going to come down to as well, really, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Whichever, yeah. If the G9 get a go, then Telstra's going to have to conform and play, or they're going to have to roll out, here we go again, another infrastructure.
Well, or the government will have to compulsorily reacquire from Telstra that last leg from the pillars to the houses.
The last mile. That's exactly right, Graham. It's something that the government's going to have to stand up and as Paul Budd was saying, they're going to have to lay down the law and
that's
say,
right.
This is what is going to happen. You are a telecommunications provider, Telstra, and the group of G9 and Optus and everybody else who wants to participate. This is the law. This is how it will work, and this is what's going to be happening.
Yep.
So in the world standings where we are, number 17, you reckon that's good?
For Australia?
For Australia. For our level.
That's shocking.
Yeah, well, I'd agree with that. For our level of, we're the quick adopters, you would think that we would have some form of...
We're quick to adopt technologies that work. Things like, CDs, DVDs, all that sort of stuff, flat screen TVs.
Mobile phones
in particular.
Text messaging.
Yep. If a technology works and is good, Australians will pick it up really quickly. So why is broadband falling so far behind? And it's because of all of these issues that we've been talking about.
Here's Senator Coonan's response to that very question.
Well, we're about equal to about the same as major developed countries. In other words, I mean, France is only one ahead of us. Germany's below us. The UK, I think, is about 10th. Even the United States only makes 12th. And that, I think, tends to indicate that this technology and the rollout of it is not like going and buying a book off a shelf. You can put in blistering fast broadband in somewhere like Korea, which is half the size of Sydney. You can put it in Korea, which is half the size of Victoria, but you're not necessarily going to get everybody who can afford it or want to use it. And Korea, which now has fibre to the home, which is perhaps the most advanced technology available at the moment of a terrestrial service, only about, I think, 14% of the population has taken it up.
It's not just Korea, though. It's European countries and places like Denmark as well. We have fibre to the home, and that is an appropriate and a good use of the technology. And to say that the fact that we're 17th and, you know, that's okay because America's here and England's here and everything else, we should be aiming to be in the top three. We should be aiming, we should have objectives to be the leader.
You look at these countries,
the world leader of this technology, and to sit on a laurels and say, oh, well, you know, 17th, that's not too bad. I think that's appalling.
But you look at the countries that she mentioned, you look how densely the population is in that country, and you look at our country, you know, we're all, our 98%'s got to be by the sea, really, doesn't it? So there's still a hell of a lot of our country which will not be adequately connected, I wouldn't have thought. And that stems back to what we were talking about, I think, 2 weeks ago on the show, where we have two technologies, wired and wireless, in this country.
Yep.
And it's really the remainder of the population, which are remote from telephone equipment and fixed lines and fibre cables and things like that, that are going to rely on this wireless technology, oh, either delivered terrestrially or from satellite.
In a country like Australia, you're not going to have one technology that's going to get to 98% of the population. It's going to have to be a mix of technologies. But in the dense areas, in Melbourne, in Sydney, in Brisbane, in the, you know, all up and down the East Coast, really, having a lot more fibre is clearly going to be the way to go.
It is, Graham. It's clearly going to be the way to go. I think we've said in the past as well, for people who are listening to the podcast or the stream and they don't live in Australia, probably 95-98% of Australia's population lives within an hour's drive of the coastline.
Yeah.
So a lot of our population is very centred down especially the east side of the country, within 100 kilometres of the coast. And we're going to need a combination of technologies to be able to encompass the entire population and deliver a satisfactory system.
Like to leave the last part of our conversation this evening to some politicians. Equal time for equal party. The federal treasurer Peter Costello got up and ranted and raved and carried on in Parliament, his right of reply was the opposition finance minister Lindsay Tanner. This is in relation to taking money from the so-called honeypot,
the future fund,
and yeah, unfortunately, this is the people that run the country.
Kevin Rudd says, is this big honeypot? I want to get elected. Let me raid this honeypot and let me put this out there as a way of getting votes. Well, he can raid the honeypot today, but let me tell you, in 10 and 15 and 20 years' time, when Australia faces its greatest economic challenge, the ageing of the population, because this bear has raided the honeypot, Australia will not be in a position to meet that great challenge.
Peter Costello's entitled to froth at the mouth, go red in the face, get all hysterical, but what he hasn't done is display leadership. Where's his plan to put Australia at the forefront of telecommunications in the 21st century? What's his answer to the small businesses all around Australia who are crying out for decent high-speed broadband? John Howard is still living in the land of the wind-up phone, and he's keeping Australia in the communications dark ages. We are committed to building the fast broadband network that all Australian businesses and consumers need and countries overseas are getting now in order to ensure that our economy can grow more, that we have stronger productivity and a stronger base to pay our obligations into the future.
We won't have a future if we don't have good quality broadband in this country.
No one will have good quality broadband unless we have better quality leaders.
No one will do business with us and we won't be able to communicate with the outside world. Let alone ourselves.
But excuse me for being a bit cynical here, but I really do think, is government cut up for this job? Can government do this for this country? Or do we really need to rely on a, you know, independent body who can see the trees for the forest, for want of a better term?
It becomes complex. I mean, don't think for one minute that anybody in government has got any understanding of technology. They're being guided by advisors. They're being guided by people who give them money, who make donations to political parties and things like that. It gets very complicated, but the short answer is no, they haven't got any technological understanding of what's going on.
But if government doesn't do it, have we seen any signs that that Telstra is going to do it as a private enterprise?
That's the problem. I don't think we've seen anyone that's got any inkling.
I mean, government might not be in a position to be the best to do it, but who's better? I mean, we need them.
Our phone number, 1-300-664-882, if you would like to say some words, which we can put to air. Or you know how to do it on the email, feedback@techtalkradio.com.au. When we return on Tech Talk Radio, we're going to talk about using the internet and making sure your website can be visible by search engines like Google, where we talk a little bit about search engine marketing and search engine optimization.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio. Subscribing to the Tech Talk Radio podcast is so easy. It's child's play.
Podcasting's so easy, even my little brother can do it.
Step one, visit the iTunes Music Store and search for Tech Talk Radio in the podcast section. Step two, click subscribe and you're done. Now every week you'll be able to listen to Tech Talk Radio whenever, wherever and however you like. You could be mowing the lawn, on a train, in a car, on a plane, at work,
visiting the relatives, washing the car. Pressing.
The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
Dr. Ron, Graham Callaghan and myself, Andrew McComb here on the panel this evening. We've vented. Our server's gone into overload if you're trying to connect to the Tech Talk Radio facilities at this point in time.
We're in the Tech Talk Radio twilight zone.
Please try again later. Oh, dear.
Did we upset the wrong people?
I don't know.
Did we say something wrong?
I don't know. Let's change the subject. Search engine optimization.
Oh, yes.
This is from connecting to the internet to using it now. People put websites up and blogs, all sorts of things, and they want it to be found in Google. Or do they? what we're going to talk about now is optimizing your website for actually being found for what you want to be found for on Google. Now, Dr. Ron, you and I, we went into the city. We were, we should probably at this point in time say we were invited by Net Registry to go along.
We were. I'm a Net Registry reseller.
Yeah.
The business that I have, and I think you are.
Yes,
well,
I have
Andrew.
Dealings with Net Registry, so we thought should put that on the table. You don't?
No.
That's good. All right.
Graham's nice and objective.
Now, the reason for sort of search engine optimization these days is because of organizations such as Google, 9MSN and all those sort of people indexing your site and coming back and continuing to re-index your site. So what we thought we would do is actually shed a bit of light onto how to do that.
We're going to be talking about Google, but this applies to all search engines. I put my thinking cap on at the start of tonight's show when I was getting ready, and I was trying to come up with 10 search engines.
Wonder what that noise was.
Yeah, it was my thinking cap. I could get to about 4 or 5
what did
at
an
absolute stretch.
Really? How'd you go?
Yeah. Google, it's just all pervasive and used
80,
by everyone.
85%, 86%.
Of all searches done on the internet today are done
according
on Google.
To Hitwise?
I could think of Yahoo.
Yeah.
The 9MSN, MSN Search,
yep.
That sort of search engine. Alta Vista I used to use before Google was big, and Lycos.
What about Telstra's half-hearted effort called Census? I mean, what do they call it?
Is Census...
Answers. Answers was one.
Yeah, that's
one. Never
used what it. What was the Census one called? I can't even remember. That was their fledgling. Why would you even try and compete with Google on that? And we got Wiki about to start one too.
Well, that's right. Wiki's going to start their own search
Wiki
engine.
Wiki search. Okay,
correct.
Well, see, Wiki don't make money on anything, and they need to turn... they're all volunteers over there, but they want to turn it into a business thing. So how do you do that? You start a search engine.
Mm, of course you do.
Anyway, search engine optimization is an established process of improving how your website interacts with search engines, thereby boosting your overall search engine ranking and website traffic. One of the things which we all probably do is we write words for people to read. Now, one of the things which came across, I think, during the course of the week is when you're writing copy, that is the words that go on the page, you want to tell Google, or the search engine for that matter, that this is a page about blue widgets, if you're selling blue widgets. You don't want to confuse the blue widgets with red widgets, with grey Who's a Majigger Watches or anything like that. It's a page about blue widgets. So when people come to your site or when people link to your site, the page is about what it says it is. Now, on a web page, there's a number of things apart from the text that you put on, the copy, which we've just mentioned. One very important thing, which a lot of people overlook, is the title of the page. How many times have you guys been to a web page and it says
new page one?
Untitled page.
Untitled.
If you do a search, if you do a search on Google for untitled page, I should actually do this while we are connected to some form of technology. I can't reach the keypad from here, and I need both hands. But if you do a search for untitled web page, chances are there'll be tens of millions of the damn things because people don't go and label their page.
Hmm.
According to Google, that's one of the most important things you can do is to put the title of the page.
Yep. It sounds like such an obvious thing, but something which people often forget.
Exactly. Now, the other thing which you can do, there's these things called meta tags. Meta tags, it's, you know, lingo, jingo, whatever you want to call it, behind the wonderful World Wide Web page front. Meta tags are just simply lines of text which are not visible to your search engine. Sorry, not visible to your readers, but are visible to your search engine. And normally there's just two ones. One's a description, which is a, you know, it was supposed to be just a single line there telling you about the page that you were on. So the meta tag is, welcome to
TikTok Radio.
Yep, and we are this. And then underneath that you have your meta, so like search tags, where you put in all your search phrases,
keywords,
and things like that.
Yeah, radio, keywords. Technology, technical, yep. Podcast.
Now, how many of you think a keyword is a word? It's a Freudian answer to this. Oh, sorry. Yes, one of those really dumb things. Well, a keyword is not a word. It's a group of words. A keyword is what you type into that little bar that lives under the words Google. How many of you type in one word?
No, I type in as many as I can, as many as I think are relevant, because I want to narrow the search and I want to get precise search results.
That's a very valid point.
Am I alone or am I...
No, that's good. So,
I hope you're not alone.
But when you think of a keyword, people think, oh, I'm going to sell cars. So a keyword is Ford. Well, yes. What about Ford Festiva? What about the brand? What about Subaru Liberty?
I would type in a suburb as well.
Yeah, yeah. Now you're thinking how people use search engines. Now, this is where search engine optimization comes into its forefront. Because it's not just Google that changes its acronyms. It's the way we use things like Google and 9MSN and how they index us. Because, after all, the search engines are there as a service to us, the users, and to present you information which is relevant to what you're looking. So, as you said, Dr. Ron, rightly so, choose lots of words to put into your keyword search.
Ford Festiva, car sales.
Suburb, maybe,
and...
Yeah.
Yeah. But, and new or used? Yeah.
And let's think you were thinking for service. Toyota service Melbourne. Toyota service Cairns. You would put in those words. So when you're thinking about putting keywords on your site, use that group of three words or four words, whatever, as a keyword so that you've got more chance of being found for that. And it means that people are being more specific in their searches, and as a result, the search engines can return a more specific set of results. Very important in today's search engine optimization. Another interesting thing, too, that Google likes is named anchors. Now, do you know what a named anchor is?
Yes.
Good. You want to tell everyone?
It's a way of giving a block of text on your site a name that you can refer to so that you can link to a particular place on the page.
Spot on. How many click here places do you think you'll find on someone's website? That's a very...
Click here is a... dreadful thing to do.
I exactly. Overuse that, and it's completely meaningless when it comes to search engines. Like if we say to have a look at this week's gadget of the week on the Tech Talk Radio website, click here.
Instead of saying click here, you say look at Tech Talk's gadget of the week and make gadget of the week the link.
That's right, but a lot of people put the words click here as the link, and it's completely meaningless when it's indexed.
Now, most search engines love named anchors because it's got the poor little robot. It's not human like us. It's a mechanical beast. It's dumb. But at least it knows where it's going when you say click here to go to the or gadget of the week or visit our gadget of the week. It'll take you through to that. So that's what they call a named anchor. And it's very important for using those to navigate through your site and to other people's sites, which is something that you need to be very aware of. Another interesting thing that came to the forefront is that Google at the moment likes putting or it likes you if you put services or... something that would draw your web readers to your site, a free thing, such as a calculator. You want to calculate how to convert A to B. And if you put a little calculator on your website, Google goes, oh, this is helpful. This is pretty good. It also means that other people that are in the same industry say, oh, there might be a, if you want to check out how to do this, click and visit this website. And it'll take you across there. And that's that in itself is a benefit to your website.
So if you've got a calculator on your page to work out how many blue widgets you need to do a particular job, then they're more likely to come to your site to calculate that and then buy their blue widgets from you.
Exactly. So as a result, the search engines are seeing you as an authoritative type of web page.
And also as providing a free service to people who are using the web as well. Not just, you're not just promoting a product or a service of yours, you're actually providing a free service online. Mm. And Google like that a lot in terms of ranking your web page.
Now, Dr. Ron, we went to the SEO conference. We're going to play a little bit about that in a minute. But one thing I'd like to touch on is what you shouldn't do on a web page. Now, how many of you do the following here? And you're probably going to cringe and go, oh, no. Okay, here's
can I have a guess?
Okay.
A website designed completely in Flash.
That's the top of the list. Yes.
There you go.
avoid using entirely Flash designs, as a majority of search engines cannot index Flash-only sites. Now, I can name half a dozen sites that are Flash-only sites. You web designers that are too clever by half, they look fantastic.
Listen up.
But functionality-wise, let me tell you, you will not be found in Google, apart from the front page or the domain name that you have on your page.
There is a way that you can actually see what the Googlebot sees.
There is.
Now, the Googlebot is the machine that Google uses to trawl through the web and look at your site and pretend that it's a user and it's visiting your site and indexing everything. And you can actually, when you type in a search on Google, you can actually click on, off the top of my head, I can't think of what it is the cache link?
You can.
To the results.
Yes.
And you can see what it is that the Googlebot is actually seeing. And on a Flash site, there's nothing there. There's no text at all, and it doesn't know how to index anything. So what Andrew's saying is very important.
On the positive side of Flash, you can use Flash. Flash looks nice. Don't use it in a navigation because Google can't see into the navigation to find the other pages that you're pointing to.
Or if you do, provide an alternative navigation tool on the same page.
What you should do is use Flash for things like banners, and don't call them banners, call them headlines. Call them anything but banners, because there are, let's take a look at Kaspersky antivirus, that'll block, out of the box, it'll block a file name called banner. So anyone using Kaspersky antivirus and you've called banner 1, banner 2, banner 3 on different pages of your website, Kaspersky will say, nah, that's advertising, I'm not going to let it through. So you've got to bear that in mind as well. Let's get back onto the list. Don't use the same color text as your background, even if it's in an image. That's a bit of a no-no.
Yes, quite often you see that. They've got a white text and a white background, but the white text is on top of a dark image. If the image displays, it's fine. But if you're not displaying the image for some reason, you can't read the text.
That's right. BMW in Europe was found guilty by the Google Meister about doing things like this and deceiving people. Because Google looks for deception. If you are deceiving people, it will not index you.
What they did was they had lots of extra keywords at the bottom of the page in the same colour text as background.
That's
so that you couldn't see it. So it was there on the page, but you couldn't read it.
So they have the word BMW.
As Maxwell Smart says, the old black text on the black background trick.
Yeah.
So they were trying to do that to leverage the ranking of their page.
Exactly. Yep. Exactly. Avoid hiding search engine rich content behind a layer. Search engines tend to favor simplistic code. Oh, how true that is.
Yep.
HTML is a wonderful thing, base standard ASP or any of the languages are good, but don't get too tricky, because as soon as you start doing Java pop-ups and stuff like that, you're going to ask for all sorts of problems when it comes to a search engine optional, sort of, you know, making it friendly for everybody. Try to avoid using frames. That went out the door years ago, but I haven't seen a site with frames in it for years. That was hideous. Remember frames?
Yeah.
Frames is like a website within a website within a website. It was like you have a top frame which stayed locked, and that was very interesting. Don't use JavaScripts or JavaScript links, what we were just talking about before, little pop-ups and things. If you do, include a text link at the bottom of each page. So that's going to make it easy for the spider to go from page A to page B without all the trickery that you're doing getting the user to go from page A to page B. Another important thing, avoid overusing keywords. Blue widget, blue widget, blue widget, blue widget. Yeah, that's just going to... It's not user-friendly, and it's going to be shunned.
Hello, BMW.
Yep. Yes. And the other important thing is what not to do on a web page is never cloak your domain name. This involves filling a page with very high quality search engine content, then redirecting it to another more user-friendly site. It's a bit like, you know, trickery. So don't do those sort of things.
Using smoke and mirrors.
That's a good way of putting it, isn't it? It's one of those things where you really do need to be a little bit considerate and a little bit conscientious of the people that you're doing. Now, most websites are put online for you and I to read. Mm. That's really the bottom line. They're not put online for search engines, and Google knows this. Now, you will hear Adam Lasnik say this from Google in the United States, hopefully next week, and he will go into detail about how they do it.
Now, there's a happy side effect of all those rules. If you do all these things to make it easy for the Googlebot to find its way around your site, you'll find that it'll also, just by chance, it'll make it easier for people with older computers to find their way around this site. For people with computers that don't run Java, for people with computers that don't run Flash, for people on mobile devices, for people using text readers, maybe who have a vision impairment.
One of the things we've tried to do with the ttr.mobi site is keep it extraordinarily simple. So it's very basic HTML,
yep.
And it means it loads fast and it's very easy to navigate.
And with style sheets, using CSS, cascading style sheets these days, it's possible to design a beautiful looking site, keeping things very, very simple so the Googlebot can find its way through, and so also that people using different technologies to access your site can find their way through.
The rule of thumb, as I think we've sort of outlined here, is make it simple. If it's good for the viewer, it's good for Google.
Mm.
And get those links up. There's a lot of things we haven't touched on here tonight. We'll hopefully talk about those in part two of our search engine optimization, which will be next week. But in the meanwhile, when you and I, Dr. Ron, went to our search engine marketing and search engine optimization thing, we cornered Sam Shetty and Justin Freeman.
We bailed him up.
We got him in the corner. Yeah. We shoved a microphone in the face and asked them a few questions. And not of the 60 minutes type either. Here's some tips from the pros.
Net Registry has been doing search engine optimization for the last 4 years, and we've basically optimized more than 1,000 sites as of now. However, we've been always focused on to small to medium-sized businesses, and we have helped people improve their online presence.
Let's start off by talking about how important meta tags are. Can you tell us a bit about what a meta tag is and how we should use them on sites?
Okay, great. Now, a couple of years back when web designers used to design websites, what they used to do is they used to put in two tags on their website. One was a meta tag description. The other one was a meta tag keyword. Now, with the meta tag description, it was basically supposed to be a one-line summary of your website, just to give the search engines an indication what the website is all about. And the meta tags were basically keywords that you'll put on a website, tell the search engine that these keywords are important to the website. However, as time went on, you know, people started misusing that, and they came across sites where they had heaps of keywords, like, you know, 50, 100 keywords on the meta keywords, and the meta description was like a long essay. So then the search engines realized that, you know, that's not a good way of looking at things, and they start giving less importance to that. Today, there are some search engines still, they give importance to it, okay, but not as much as they used to do it a couple of years back. However, having said that, you know, it makes a lot of difference. For example, if you have a website and some of the keywords which are important to you are misspelled very regularly, it's a good thing to put that on your meta tag keywords, because you know you don't want to spoil it on your text by having misspelled words on your website. It's a good thing to put on the meta tags.
Do some search engines look at meta tags differently to others?
Yes, I mean, to some extent, you know, Yahoo and MSN, they still look into that. Google may not to that extent, but they do. I mean, it's no harm in having it, but if you're having it, make sure that you're not overdoing it.
So overdoing it would be 100, 10, 20?
Ideally speaking, we recommend that you should have, you know, you got to understand that each page of your website could have different meta tags. Each page on your website would have a different product that you're trying to specify on. To try to make sure that the most important keywords for your website are there on the first page, okay? Try not to exceed more than 10 keywords on each page, and make sure that you're not repeating the same on each and every page.
Blogs are becoming very popular these days, especially on US servers in particular, I guess. How important is a blog in achieving links to your website?
Okay, now, in terms of, you know, getting to results with search engines, it's just not one factor. There are too many factors onto it. Yes, blogs are getting important. Provided you have a good blog, the blog is on topic, and you're making people, you know, write good contents on it. Because the more often you get contents from, you know, updates from various websites, Google starts giving it important, because the blog might be of a topic which is of a lot of interest to people. And if you have a blog on that, then definitely it's going to help your popularity.
Now, another popular thing these days is XML files, or the files that sort of sit in the background of a website, which tells browsers about dynamic content. That's content that lives on your website, which changes regularly, such as a podcast, an RSS feed of sorts. XML files come in fairly high in the Google ranks. Do sites with XML feeds feature high for this reason?
At the moment, yes. Even if you, you know, if you look at recommendations from Google, when they say, you know, you have a Google sitemap, they actually say, you know, put in an XML sitemap. Because that's what, you know, at the moment, there's a good, you know, chance that if you have an XML thing coming on your website, it's going to push you up much more up the ladder.
You touch on XML sitemaps. It's something that I'm doing for each of my clients these days using the free XML generators online. Are they as good as each other, or is one better than other?
What you can do is actually, Google has just recently introduced something which is pretty interesting in terms of search engines. A lot of people, you know, used to do certain Google commands on Google, like, you know, link domain to find out how many people are linking back. But what Google has done now is you can actually go to www.google.com/webmasters. Once you log in out there, it basically will give you an entire information about your website. It'll tell you what keywords on your website has Google already picked up, how many pages of your website has been indexed by Google, and with regards to sitemap, it'll help you basically with putting up the sitemap and so on.
And one of the old myths, is it a myth? Links on the site on the same server. So if you're running, say, take, for example, the Net Registry server, and you have many customers, they're linking to each other. Is that detrimental in Google's eyes?
It's a bit of a tough one because, you know, a company like Net Registry, for example, you know, we have close around 50,000 websites hosting with us, you know, and it's not fair that, you know, you could say that anyone, you know, hosting with Net Registry, if someone else links to that, it's not of value, because what would really happen is, you know, you could have large ISPs which are hosting a lot of websites, okay, and you would have one person linking to the other, but, you know, it wouldn't be not fair for the person, you know, if he's losing on his ranking because he is, you know, linking to someone who's hosting the same server. So
it's a good question. Look, Google's pretty smart, and I'm confident that if they see an IP that has 40 sites behind it, and each of those 40 sites are linking to each other, they could be pretty certain that it's could be run by the same number of webmasters. However, with the increase of shared or virtual hosting, where many sites share the same IP, if it looks an IP address and there is 20,000 websites behind it, I'm sure that Google's smart enough to recognise that that's a valid way of hosting. I don't think that it's... I'm of the opinion that it's not going to penalise you for a link from a shared hosting as opposed to from a dedicated hosting box on a different IP?
The reason I ask about that is because of blogs. A lot of ISPs or hosting companies will run a blog in the same web package. And obviously, if you want to link back into your website, hopefully the blog is not going to penalise you, or it's not going to be looked at detrimentally back into your site.
Yeah, I think it would... look, at the worst-case scenario, if links from a similar or same IP or IP range, I think at the worst case scenario they could have nil effect. They're certainly not going to have a harmful effect or penalise you.
Just because you've jumped in, Justin, can you just tell me your role at Net Registry?
Good question. Look, I'm a channel manager. I essentially look after the resellers, so the web design partners of Net Registry. So we look after web designers, network experts, but essentially our core business is web designers, people building websites and using Net Registry domain names and website hosting.
Search engine optimization has quite often been tainted with an interesting brush. Some people believe in it, some people don't. How do search engine optimization companies differ?
Essentially, search engine optimization as a service, it's increasingly becoming an important offering for most hosting companies. I think that the big difference between companies is the results that they've achieved. And I think that any search engine optimization company who themselves doesn't appear for search engine optimization would have a tough job convincing you to pay for their service.
So it's a good rule of thumb test, really. Go and see if they've found on the search engine.
Exactly.
Is it possible to over-optimize a site in this day and age?
It's a tough question. I think that Google as an organisation is an anti-search engine optimisation, but they certainly don't want to make our job any easier. So I'm sure that Google is aware that companies sell search engine optimisation, and perhaps they have a strategy to limit the success of organisations who are getting close to capitalising on their algorithm? So, look, the short answer is I don't know, but I'm certainly sure that Google's aware that search engine optimization is a multi-million dollar industry, and they need to protect their algorithm, and their algorithm is delivering relevant results based on the keyword.
Why do you think Google does have the market share that it does? Just out of curiosity, is it because they're on the block first, it's an easy word, people just remember Google, and you know, even these days it's become its own verb almost. Why do you think Google has the market share that it does?
Look, they've got a patent. I understand that they enjoy a patent on the PageRank technology. So the linking strategies from Yahoo, 9MSN aren't as great. Will Google always be there? I'm not sure. Look, Wiki's launching its own search engine in 2 months' time, and if that search engine tends to be gives more relevant results, you know, Google has to protect its own existence. Google's main source of income is selling pay-per-click, and if it's not delivering relevant results, it's not going to exist. So,
we were discussing Wiki on the show recently, and one of the models behind Wiki was the fact that Wiki earns no money currently, and the way it can generate money is by putting its own search engine and its own pay-per-click issues there. So hence, maybe that's probably the reason why they're launching their thing, to actually generate some money.
Yeah, I understand it's run almost solely by volunteers at the moment, so it'll be interesting to see how that pans out.
All right, back to the web stuff. Anchor text, you use that terminology quite a bit. Can you tell people what anchor text is? Well, yeah, is that a question for Sam?
Yeah, sure. Basically, when you link, you know, one website to the other, okay, there are normally when you link, you know, you'd either put in a button which says click here, and it takes you to a website. Rather than putting something like click here, you could actually, you know, put a text which says, you know, web hosting Melbourne, for example. Okay, and so when someone clicks on that, it actually takes you to a website which is about web hosting provider in Melbourne. So what you're doing is, by putting in an anchor text, you're telling the search engine spider that the page that they're going to land onto is all about web hosting company in Melbourne.
You're saying remove the words click here and put in the words web hosting Melbourne and make that as your underscore.
As a hyperlink, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, okay. And another question is keywords. The word keyword assumes one word, but that's not the case. Keyword can be a string of words. How does that work?
Okay, the thing is that, you know, people use keyword and use keyword phrases, okay? So basically keyword is nothing but actually, if you look at it, it's a collection of two or three words. Okay, you could, depending upon what stage of your search in, you could either put in a single word to do a search, or you could use two words, you know, together to do a search. So when we use terms in search engine optimization, when we speak to customers, we ask them what keywords are important to them. But what we actually mean is that what would someone type in Google, Yahoo, or MSN if they are to find their services? So a keyword could be a single word, it could be two words, three words, or more than that. I mean, if you look at trends, you know, someone if is typing in three words in a search, they're being a bit more specific what they're looking out for. That means they are in a stage where they might be just two or three steps away from actually making a decision. So if you're optimizing your website, it makes more sense to go for a three-word keyword rather than a single word, because when you're typing in a single word, you're just doing research. You've not made up your mind. You've not decided what you want to do. But when you search for a larger collection of words, you know, you made it very specific what you're interested in, and your decision is basically based on those 10 results which come up then.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Thanks to Net Registry for allowing us to have a chat to them like that and grilling them in the corner.
There's some good information in there. It was a good one.
It's worthwhile having a listen back if you're listening on the podcast. When you sit down and have a look at your website, have a bit of a re-listen to that and apply some of those technologies, and I reckon you'll have a website which is going to be very search engine friendly.
Thanks to Sam and Justin at Net Registry. That was a terrific afternoon. 4 weeks to 6 months for a new site to appear on Google, they told us.
Yeah. You can speed that up. If you need to know, come talk to us. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio. We're running out of time. We'll be back with more after this.
Listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Tech Talk Radio wants your feedback. Call the Tech Talk Radio feedback line or visit our website and tell us your thoughts on the show. Tell us your likes and dislikes, your technical dilemmas and program suggestions. Call 1-300-664-882 and leave a voice message. That's 1-300-664-882 or visit our website, techtalkradio.com.au, and click on the feedback link.
Next week on Tech Talk Radio, we'll tell you all about search engine optimization. Google has 80% of the search engine market here in Australia. So if you've ever had to build a website or you're about to build one, next week's show is not to be missed. We'll hear exclusively from Sam Shetty and Justin Freeman from Australia's Net Registry, along with expert opinion from the Google search evangelist himself, Adam Lasnik, from Googleplex at Mountain View in California.
The way I think is a better approach is, how do we optimize our site for users? That typically translates into better crawling, indexing, and ranking on Google, and I would assume the other engines as well.
A not-to-be-missed program next week on Australia's premier tech talk show, Tech Talk Radio.
In this house, we obey the laws of thermodynamics!
Cool!
Tech Talk Radio's Gadget of the Week.
Out of my own!
Released in Australia last week, Friday, the 23rd of March, the one you've all been waiting for, Sony's PS3.
Oh, yeah. Have you got one yet?
I haven't got one just yet.
This is your gadget. You can do your SETI interface.
It is my gadget, indeed. Well, I thought of that when you mentioned the SETI interface last week.
Except for cancer. Go back and listen to last week's podcast if you haven't heard it.
That's the one, yes. Researching cancer using idle processor speed. But that's not important right now. 20 gig hard disk version, $800-something. The 60 gig version, just a tad under $1,000. It's been a delay of almost 4 months releasing the PS3.
Why is that? Is that because they just couldn't keep up demand?
No. There was a technical issue and they held off, I believe. The original release date was November last year. About 1 million units have been shipped to the markets that use the PAL television standard, which includes us and Europe as part of the launch.
Sony, so they released on a technology basis, did they?
I believe so. Sony has remained tight-lipped about how many were specifically earmarked for Australia. The good thing about it is you can play games on it. But
That's damn expensive, isn't it?
It is, but however, you can also, on this one, PS3, surf the web wirelessly, rip and play MP3s, video chat with other PS3 users, display digital images, read a variety of memory cards, and it contains the cheapest Blu-ray player on the market.
Yeah, but it's in a very expensive games console.
Well, it's cheaper as a Blu-ray. If you bought it just to play Blu-ray discs, it's cheaper than buying a Blu-ray disc player.
Exactly right, Graham.
Really?
Yeah, just wanted a Blu-ray player rather than spend $1,800 on the next cheapest
machine.
And
it's got the high-def output. It'll connect to your high-def plasma screen or whatever. So, yeah.
If you're a brand new PS3 owner and you're excited, post us on
the
forum or send us an email.
Compatibility with PlayStation 2 is in software, not in hardware.
Jeff Gates
has
got one.
So,
Jeff Gates is our listener from the US, one of our many regulars over there.
Oh,
he's
yes.
got a PlayStation 3. I wonder if he's given it to the kids yet.
He camped out like you do to get movie tickets.
Did.
Yeah.
He did.
No, his wife got one.
That's right. He found it in the display cabinet. Just passing. Can I have that one, please?
And she rang him up and said, oh, look what I've got for you, dear.
Ah, yeah. All right, so that was the Tech Talk Radio Gadget of the Week.
Here it is, everybody. The world's greatest website.
Tech Talk Radio Website of the Week.
And the Website of the Week follows along in the theme of this evening, that is search engine optimization. When you write a website, when you build a website probably, one of the great things you should do these days is put a little XML, which is extensible markup language file in the very top part of where you put your web page, and it's called sitemap.xml. And what that's for is for the search engines. It's a bit of a clue. It's like the old robots.txt file, only on steroids, I think. It's actually come up a bit in the world and actually says when to come back and index the page, how often it changes, and all that. Now, if you want to have a look and put a sitemap on your site, the first place to visit is sitemaps, that's plural, .org. And it's actually by Google. If you go there, it's a very plain Jane sort of site, but it has all the information that you could possibly want. Dr. Ron, have you put anything like this on any of your sites yet?
No, I haven't. I always put a robots.txt file there, but do you still need a robots.txt file on your website?
That's a very good question, actually.
Should do a little bit more research.
Maybe we'll ask the boys up north and see what they say.
Yeah, I haven't used a sitemaps.xml file, but you use them with the sites you build?
Yeah, you can. Yeah, I do. And you can generate them on... There's many free ones out there too. Just do a search online. Even on the Google site here, sitemaps.org, it'll tell you where to go and do your generation for you. So it basically does a sitemap of what you've got online, and then you just add a few extra bits and pieces, and you can see what search engines actually aren't finding along the way. So that's the Tech Talk Radio Website of the Week, sitemaps.org.
There is a fine line between genius and madness.
Showtime. Missed it by that much.
I know nothing. Nothing.
Houston, we have a problem.
The Odd Spot on Tech Talk Radio.
And with a bit of time to spare this evening, Dr. Ron,
favourite part of the evening.
I hate to think.
And thanks to GD for this contribution. As many countries around the world adjust their clocks to mark the beginning or end of daylight saving, which we just did.
We did last Saturday.
Yep. One British newspaper, the Daily Telegraph, has suggested we should ditch the idea and just make it GMT everywhere around the world.
That works for me.
Greenwich Mean Time. Yeah.
Greenwich Mean Time, taking its name from Greenwich in southeast London, is the local time in Britain during the winter and is used across the globe as the time of reference. But the Daily Telegraph, a staunchly patriotic broadsheet, said the clock-switching lark was plain irritating, and it came up with its own cunning plan to get the world's clocks ticking to a British beat.
And it's not even April the 1st yet.
It's not. It's not.
It's bizarre, isn't it? GMT, when they've gone on to daylight saving, so they're actually an hour ahead of themselves, haven't they?
That's
they're plus 1 hour or something like that.
They've gone on the same time we came off daylight saving. So the people I talk to in the UK on a regular basis, we're now 2 hours difference from the difference that we were.
You would have been 9 hours before.
We were 11 hours different, and now we're 9 hours different. Yeah.
As a British initiative, said the Daily Telegraph, let it be known as Greenwich Global Time.
Well, just as a bit of an adjunct to that too, did you know that we now no longer, the time reference, we now reference to France instead of the UK?
Yeah, we gave it
on UTC.
Yeah, UTC, that's right. When did that happen? That was about 12 months ago or something, wasn't it?
That's been going on for a long time now.
Oh, good. See, there you go. I miss it. You've been listening to Tech Talk Radio. I'm Andrew McComb, Dr. Ron, and Graham Callaghan tonight being the panel next week. It's going to be a bit of a... We're going to play some interviews that we've done.
Yeah, and we're going to continue search engine optimization. We're going to be hearing from Adam Lesnick from Google.
We are indeed. So same time, same station, you're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Tech Talk Radio is brought to you each and every week by a band of dedicated professionals from within the broadcasting, IT and telecommunications industries. The team consists of executive producer and host Andrew McComb, producer Dr. Ron, panellists Sir Graham Callaghan and Mark Diggins. Our US correspondent is Lydia Davis. Production facilities are courtesy of Evolving Communications, podcast production by Graham Callaghan. Tech Talk Radio is broadcast, recorded and streamed live to the world each and every Monday night from 8 p.m. The producers wish to thank all the stations that are taking the show, including 3WBC, 3XX, Cairns FM and 4KZ. For syndication, sponsorship and advertising, call 03 9018 9043 or visit the website techtalkradio.com.au for more information. This has been a production of Tech Talk Radio Vic and is subject to copyright and applicable laws and may not be rebroadcast without approval.
Entertaining, informative and independent. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.